Okay, let's begin. Somebody remind me what the last thing we...
We weren't here.
I'm on two different...
We were here last week.
No, we weren't here last week. Because
and 2 weeks ago, we weren't here. 2 weeks ago, we were here.
And it was only a few of us.
Right.
Right. So anybody have a recollection of where we were at?
You expect us to remember from 2 weeks ago.
Kind of give us a little hint.
Well, I think we were looking at Tfilat Chana, right?
Yes.
We were talking about her tefillah.
Yes, you were.
And I think we read through Perek Aleph, in which she seems to have a conflict with Eli and a conflict with Pnina, and who's chiding her and poking fun at her and getting her just upset, and finally she goes into the mikdash to offer a prayer, has this a prayer for a child. We raise the question about the oddity of her request, which is to have a child that she can then lend back to God. So what quite is the purpose of having a child if your goal is ultimately l'hash'ilot l'Hashem, to give him back or to lend him to God? And ultimately, that's precisely what she does. She takes his child, she brings him back to the Mikdash, she leaves him with Eli and says, okay, now you raise him. So what was the purpose of having him altogether? She's going to leave him in Eli's charge to raise. And then we brought this to a head in Chana's Tefillah. Because Chana's Tefillah, which is Perek Bet, after she has this child and after she brings him back to the Mikdash, and she says, I have given him to God, Anochi Hishiltiu LaHashem, she offers a tefillah. And in this tefillah, she seems to say some remarkable things. She talks about her enemies and the joy she has over her victory over her enemies. Ki rechav pi al oivai, ki samachti bishuatecha. This is the beginning of Perek Bet. Correct? She is alatz libi b'Hashem, ramakani b'Hashem. Her heart is jumping. Her heart is rejoicing. She is singing the praises of God because she's been victorious over her enemies. And if we take the simple reading of the midrash and the mafarshim, that this is a reflection of her sense of victory over Pnina, then this tefillah really is quite harsh. Because it seems in every phrase of this tefillah, her description of the conflict with Pnina gets worse, not better. So that's, I think, the last thing we did was to go through this tefillah.
It doesn't sound like a happy.
No, and that's
new mother.
No, and that's part of the remarkable part of this tefillah. It really is quite it's quite astounding. The tefillah, Chana davens twice. In the story of Chana's birth of Shmuel, there are two places where she offers a tefillah. Her initial tefillah, where she pours out her heart because she wants a child, where we don't know what she says, except for the neder that she takes. And then there's second tefillah, the text of which we have here, and the text of which is the foundation of many of the psukim and many of the Pirkei Tehillim of Hallel. Okay? So for this Hallel of Chana to be a reflection of the conflict between her and Pnina is really remarkable. I'm going to share with you this. I don't think I gave you this source page. Did I give you this piece with the psikta about the children? No. I'm going to share this with you only because it intensifies the question. It doesn't resolve any answers, but it does intensify the question. I think it's valuable to see. I'm going to pass that down. We'll look at it in 1 second. Well, let's just do a quick review of the
tefillah
that are so negative. I mean, with this negative connotation. Well, it's only negative connotation in the sense, because that's how we have interpreted it so far.
Okay, if we interpret it like that,
really out of the negative? Really extraordinary. It's really extraordinary.
It's not the concept of tefillah.
No, it's well. There's a concept of thanksgiving for tefillah.
Okay, but
this
is not
really
quite the same.
Yeah, it's really quite extraordinary. But there are certainly phrases here that are very reminiscent of aspects of tefillah. Ein kadosh ka Hashem ki ein biltecha ve'ein sur ki Elokeinu. We have an entire tefillah built around that pasuk, which is pasuk bet, perek bet, pasuk bet. Ein kadosh ka Hashem ki ein biltecha ve'ein sur ki Elokeinu. Ein ki Elokeinu, exactly. The entire tefillah of Ein ki Elokeinu is built around this phrase. Ein kadosh ka Hashem, ein sur ki Elokeinu. Right? This is there's none like you. There's none as holy as you. It's a wonderful tefillah. So every time you say Ein ki Elokeinu, Shirat Hayam is a victory over Mitzrayim.
Yeah. So I'm saying it's okay. It's pretty harsh.
It is. It's very harsh, but it's at least it's about the destruction of Egypt. There are many tefillot that are tefillot of thanksgiving over our victory enemies. Over our enemies. Right. Tefillat David, over his wars. Tefillat Shirat Hayam, Shirat Ha'Be'er, Shirat Devora, correct? With all of its complexity. What makes this tefillah extraordinary for us is that at least at this point all we have to work with is the assumption that she's talking about Penina as her enemy, and that's really an astounding perspective.
So you think there might be another
right. I keep putting in the alleged and the alluding and the possibility because in order for me to sort of make sense of all of this, I'm going to share with you a chiddush that I heard from Madame, but in order to make sense of all of this, I think we're going to have to reframe who our enemies are. And ultimately what the source of her conflict is. But we have a few steps to go, and I'm not quite sure we're going to get there before October. So, but back to this tefillah for a moment. Al tarbut dabu gvoha gvoha yetzei atak mipichem. Don't speak so loftily, so haughtily, so arrogantly. Ultimately, God is the God of knowledge, God of plans. All plans belong to God. God makes things happen. And then she starts talking in language which is very militaristic. Keshet giborim chatim v'nichshalim azuchayil, breaking the bow of the enemy, bringing down the bow of the enemy. Sveim balechem niskaru, those who are satiated with bread. Those who are satiated for bread are now hiring themselves out for bread. Sveim balechem niskaru, ure evim chadelu, and those who were hungry cease to be hungry. In other words, part of the whole tefillah is this topsy-turvy perspective, that everything is now in reverse. That which was successful is now unsuccessful. That which were those who were unsuccessful are now successful. So in terms of her blessing, she's now been blessed with a child. The only question now is who's the other half of this feel referring to, but the topsy-turvy nature of every pasuk reflects the same idea. Those who had bows, those who were strong in war, were nichshal. They were the ones who failed. They were the ones who were broken. Those who were hungry, those who were satiated are now hungry. Those who were hungry are now satiated. Sveim balechem niskaru urevim chadelu. And then, of course, the famous phrase, ad akara yalda shiva verabat banim umlala. Well, the woman who was barren had seven, the one who had many has become a widow, or has become childless, has become distraught. Hashem memit umchaye. There, in very encapsulated phrase, is the pasuk that we have in Hallel. Hashem memit umchaye, God who causes to die, who brings causes to live. Morit sha'ol vayal, brings it down into the depths and brings them up. Hashem Morish Umashir, God whom impoverishes and who makes wealthy. Mashpil Afmiromem, who lowers down, who raises up. Mekim Me'afardal, lifts up out of the dust the poor. Me'ashpot Yerim Evyon, out of the dung heap he brings up the destitute. Lashiv Im Nidivim, to sit them with nobility. So again, this is right from Hallel. Who is she talking about? And give them a throne of glory and of honor. God's foundation is the earth. He will protect the feet of the pious ones. Who are the pious ones here? Who's protecting here? The wicked ones will go in darkness. come back to the same question. To reflect this tefillah against Pnina is really quite remarkable. Gila b'choach yigbar ish. Man will not be victorious by strength. Where did strength? Where did the militaristic tone of this tefillah appears in every verse? Hashem yichatu mirivav. God will break down his enemies. Alav b'shamayim yareim. Cry out against them from the heavens. Hashem yadin af se'aretz. He will judge the edges of the earth. V'yiten oz l'malko. He will give strength to his king. V'yarem keren mishicho. And elevate the crown of his anointed one.
Where did the king come from?
Where did this come from? Keren, Mashiach, Malach, oz, gevura. It's harsh and it's militaristic. So again, Chazal clearly put part of the story into the conflict between Pnina and Chana. Whether they did so midrashically because they wanted to see that also in part of her tefillah, or whether they saw that as the pshat is unclear. Mefarshim, many of them, Rashi, Radak, starting with the very first pasuk, Rachav pi aloivai, point to her enemies is referring to Pnina. Or Pnina v'chavroteha, Pnina and her friends, because it's in the plural. Which, again, it's very very complicated. In the medrash that I gave you, source number one, you can just see how intensely Chazal directed our attention here. Before actually you do that, you need to look at another pasuk. If you look at the end of Perek Bet, not quite the end, pasuk. Pasuk Chaf. After Chana brings the child, did we do this pasukim where Chana brings Shmuel to Eli?
She stayed home. At one point, you told us how she stayed home.
Correct.
She let the child go because.
After this tefillah, there's a little episode about Chofni and Pinchas, which we're going to leave for now. And then we get to Pasuk Yirchet. Perek Bet Pasuk Yirchet. Shmuel misharet et pnei Hashem. She left Shmuel in Eli's charge. Shmuel is serving God. Na'ar chagur ephod bad. Young child wearing some kind of ephod of cloth, some sort of garment. He's living in the Mikdash, so not surprising that he's going to wear clothing that is reminiscent of the clothing of the Kohanim. He's just living amongst them. Me'il katon tasela imo. He's got an ephod, he's got a me'il. These are classic examples of big day kuhuna. Va'altala miyamim yamima, ba'alota al'isha, lizboach et zevach hayamim. Every year when Chana would come visiting the Mikdash with her husband to bring korbanot, she would bring him next size up of the me'il. She's got visiting rights. Once a year
she
gets
a lot, I thought. They didn't just go up once a year.
Well, once a couple of times a year, but every time she went up, she got to visit her son.
And she brought him
another me'il. Finally, Verach Eli et Elkanah ve'et Ishto. Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife. V'yamah, yasem Hashem lecha zera min ha'isha hazot tachat ha'she'ela asher sha'ala la'Hashem. God should give you other children in lieu of the one you have lent to God. Come back to that same theme that we talked about a couple of classes ago, that this Shmuel is sha'ul me'Hashem, and hish'il la'Hashem. He's both borrowed from God and lent back to God. Requested of God and lent to God. So Eli says to him, well, I'll give you a bracha, you should have other children. So indeed, God blessed her and she had other children. She had three sons and two daughters. And the child grew up with God. So in the Medrash, when the Medrash talks about Rabat Banim Umlala, it's just something astounding. At one point or another, when Elkanah was teasing her, he said to her, am I not better than you or good as good for you as 10 children? Asarabanim. So the Medrash says, Elu asarabanim shopnina. These 10 children that he's referring to are 10 children of Pnina's. ולא עשה אלא כשבא לפקור את חנה, הייתה חנה יולדת בן אחד, ופנינה קוברת שני בנים. For every child, says the Medrash, for every child that Chana bore, Penina buried two.
That's horrible.
Wait, now we've got to go through the math. Yalda Chana arba'a, Upnina koveret shmona. By the time she has four children, Penina has buried eight. Vaita Chana mu'beret ben chamishi. Chana eventually is pregnant now with the fifth. V'nityara Penina shelo tikbor shnei banea sheyishtaru la. And Penina is afraid that they'll die too, and she'll be left with nothing. Ma'asta Penina halcha ubiksha min Chana, ve'amra la, bevakasha mimech, neheneti lach. Yodat ani shechatati lach. She says to him, I know that I've sinned to you. I know that I have been terrible to you. Vaterli kedei sheyichyu shnei banei sheyishtaru li. I pray that the last two children should survive. So Chana prayed that Kadosh Baruch Hu should leave Penina's last two children. Amar la Kadosh Baruch Hu, Chayecha she'ayu ru'uyot lamut, ela ho'il she'nitpalalt aleihem she'yichyu, l'shemech ani korei otam. Therefore, because you prayed for them, they were essentially in your hands to give them the right to live, I will count them in your credit. לפיכך הוא אומר, עד הכרה ילדה שבעה שנתחשבו לה שני בניה של פנינה. In the tefillah, she says, עד הכרה ילדה שבעה. But in the pasuk, it says she only has five. Three boys, two girls. So there's a discrepancy between the numbers. When she talks about her seven children in the tefillah, or she talks about seven children in the tefillah, and the pasuk tells me she only has five. So the Medrash resolves that discrepancy by suggesting that the last two remaining children of Penina were counted to her credit. But you understand, Chazal understanding the pasuk ad akara yalda shiva verabat banim umlala, as a reflection of the conflict between Chana and Penina. Chana is having children, Penina is burying children. And that was really the question that I thought, in the end, is the most remarkable part of all of this, because the image of Chana in one room singing Hallel for the birth of a child while Penina and Elkanah are in the next room over sitting Shiva for the loss of a child is a picture that is just unconscionable. And it's not in the text. What we do with this pasuk of Rabat Banim Umlala we'll figure out, but that's not necessarily the pshat on the text, because I'll put it into the Midrash. And the question of why, but ultimately to put it back into the pshat of the text is very difficult. As the Mefarshim suggests, that these enemies that she's talking about are in fact Penina and her friends is really a very difficult suggestion. So I think that's sort of where we left off as far as the question. Correct? Does that sound familiar as we get to all this? So I need to come back to the source of what I think is the key to unraveling some of the mystery, which is the conversation that Chana and Eli have in the Beit HaMikdash. When Chana walks into the Mikdash in Perek Aleph and makes a request to have a child, because ultimately, to make a request to have a child and then at the same breath make a neder that you're going to give this child back to God and bring him up in the temple and have him re-raised by Eli. Now, every concept, every part of this request and neder is extraordinary and unexpected. So I think that that's going to be the centerpiece of our conversation. Let's go back to Pasuk Yud, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud. Vehimarat nafesh, she was bitter. Vatitpalel al Hashem, uvachot tivke. She cried to God. She prayed. She cried. Vatidoneder vatamar Hashem tzvaot imnaot ileh bo'ani amatecha. God of hosts, if you see the affliction, the pain of your maidservant, zchartani v'lo tishkachat amatecha. Remember me. Do not forget me. V'natatala amatcha zera anashim. Give me seed of children. Unetativ la Hashem koyemei chayav umara lo yale avosho. I will give him back to God, and he, a razor will not come upon his head. We have not yet even begun to discuss the Nazirut aspect of her neder. Eli standing there, he's watching her, and he's watching her
mouth.
She's moving her lips, no voice. And because of that, Eli considered her drunk, to which he responds harshly. Now, Chazal, in this moment, again, in the Midrash, pick up on nuances that aren't necessarily reflected in the Pshat, but that are reflected in a sort of conceptual framework that Chazal had. And one of those issues is that these two psukim form the basis for many of the halachot of tefillah. That I'm sure you've heard before, right? The tefillah, the choreography of the Shemoneh Esrei, is built around Chana's tefillah. Actually, the source for it is a Gemara in Brachos, and I gave it to you in source number 3, just so you have a sense of some of it. Amar Rav Hamnuna, Kama Hilchata Gavravta Ika L'mishma Mihani Kroi Dachana. How many important laws can be derived from this conversation between these psukim about Chana? It says, V'chana mindaberet aliba, that she spoke from the heart, Mikan li mitpalel shishtarich l'chaven libo. From here we derive the halacha that you have to have kavana, you have to have focus on what you're saying, that she spoke from the heart. Rak svata na'ot, her lip moved, mikan mitbalel shiachtoch bisvata. From here we derive the halacha that you actually have to move your lips when you pray, you have to actually recite the words. On the other hand, v'kolalo yishamea mikan shasur lakbia kolo bitvila. On the other hand, you're not allowed to articulate those words, they can't be audible. It's a very delicate balance. That's what Shemoneh Esrei is. It's a very delicate balance between actually speaking but not being heard. Rak svatea na'ot v'kola lo yishamer. V'achshaveh eli l'shikura mikan sheshikura asur lipalel. Right? Drunk, you're not allowed to daven. Right? Because that would be a violation of, that would be equivalent to the Aaron's children who walked into the Mikdash drunk, right? Avodah is Avodah. Tefillah is part of the Avodah. Right, the rest of it is not relevant for our discussion. But he clearly saw or perceived her to be shikor, drunk, and therefore inappropriately conducting herself. In the pshat of the story, I think there's another aspect of Eli's concern of her. And I don't think it's necessarily only the fact that she's moving her lips and not speaking. It's not clear to us that that's not necessarily a form of tefillah that others, in other words, Chazal saw it as the first place this is referenced. But that's not necessarily clear. Or a given that nobody else ever davened this way, that because she was moving her lips and not speaking, he thought that she was drunk. But what is clear, what I think is also true, is that he never heard what she prayed about. In other words, the fact that she's moving her lips and not speaking means for him that A, she's conducting herself in a manner that's out of the ordinary, but it also means that Eli never has the opportunity to hear what it is that she's said. And it's clear from the aftermath of the story that Eli never has not yet understood what she has prayed for. Because 3 psukim later, when he blesses her, he says, L'chil shalom, v'lokei yiso yitenet shelatecha shesha'alt me'imo. In Pasuk Yud Zion. Go in peace, and may God grant your request.
How many times has he seen women praying like this anyway? I mean, was this a...
That's an interesting question. We're going to talk about that.
She didn't get a lot of gas anyway.
I know, but...
Didn't get a lot of what?
Gas. But this had to have been an uncommon sight, unless it wasn't, I don't know.
Right. Well, that's part of what we're going to talk about. Oh, how common or uncommon was it? And ultimately... he thought she was drunk because she was praying altogether, or because she was praying without speaking, or because she was moving her lips? What aspect of
right?
So it's a famous word of the Vilna Gaon that he misread the Urim V'Tumim. The Urim V'Tumim spoke in code. So the letters that popped up in the Urim V'Tumim were Shikara, Shin Chaf, Resh Hei, and they were really to be rearranged into the word Kshera. So the Vilna Gaon says that's what was going on, that he was reading the Urim V'Tumim, and the Urim V'Tumim said that she was an Isha Kshera, and he misread the letters as Isha Shikara. But again, all of these, I think, are reflecting a miscommunication between Eli and Chana. So part of our challenge is to understand what exactly is the dynamic that's going on, what is she concerned about, and how did Eli miss it. But in all cases, in Pasuk Yudalid, Vayomer Elea Eli ad matai tishtakarin asiri yetinech me'alayich, her response to his accusation that she was drunk is Pasuk Tetvav. Vatan Chana v'tomer, lo adoni, isha kshatruach anochi. I am a bitter woman, I am not drunk. V'yein v'shechad lo shatiti. V'eshpoch etzu nafshi lifnei Hashem. I have poured out my heart to God. She does not tell him what she has said. Which is really strange, too. Why don't you just say, I'm barren, I don't have children, I came to pray for a child. She never tells him what she's asking for, and he never asks. The only thing she says is, Pasuk Tet Zayin, Al titen et amatcha lifnei bat Belial. Do not make out your maidservant to be a worthless person. Right? Bat Belial. I've spoken out of anger. I've spoken out of frustration. I've spoken out of my pain and angst. To which he responds from that pain and says, "Fine, okay, it's an lech l'shalom, and God should give you whatever you requested for." It's very innocent, passing comment. At the end of the parak, when she comes back with the child, then she tells him.
Is this the basis for wishing to be a Nazir because of this whole wine business where he thought she was Shikar?
No, the Nazir is a pasuk in the Torah. The pasuk of the Torah is not allowed to drink wine.
No, it has to do with her. She makes a netter to God.
Yeah.
Right. Why she puts the Nazirut into this issue, we'll see. We will talk about that at length, but that's a long... We have a
while to go.
A while to get to that.
Do you think she's basing it on Shimshon?
I think there's a connection, but there's more to it. We're going to come to. But take a look at Pasuk Chav. Chav Hey, Chav Tal and Chav Hey. They come back. They bring a year or two later. They bring all kinds of korbanot. Parim Shlosha, Eifa, Achat Kemach, and Nevayayin. They bring all kinds of korbanot, and finally. Pasuk Chavav, or the end of Chavav, Vayaviu et hanar el Eli, Vatome bi Adoni, Chay nafshecha Adoni. This is 2 years later. She comes back and she brings this child and she says to Eli, "My master, on your life," takes an oath, "Ani ha'isha hanitzevet imcha bazeh. Remember me, I was the one who was standing here." This is 2 years later. I was the one who was standing here. Litpalel al Hashem, davening to Hashem. He asked me before if this was ordinary. Right. 2 years later, she says to him, "I was the woman who stood here and davened." I guess it wasn't as ordinary as we might have thought. El hanar hazeh hitpalalti. This is who I davened for. This is who I was praying for. V'iten Hashem li et she'elati asher sha'alti me'emo. As you said, what was his words? His words, "Yiten Hashem et she'elatech asher sha'alt." She says exactly that. God has given me my request. V'gam anochi hish'ilti u la'Hashem. So I am bringing him back. Kol yamim asher haya u'sha'u la'Hashem. He is lent back to God. Eli, here he is. He's yours. Now you raise him. Remarkable statement. Remarkable statement. So I think there's a problem here, and I think there's a clear. We spent a lot of time developing the question of this problem. There's an issue driving her angst. There's an issue driving her pain. Chazal saw Penina as the focus of that issue. we would have a difficult time putting that back into the text. The question ultimately is what does go back into the text as the substantive source of her angst. So I share with you an interesting observation of that I heard from Rav Meidan. It's a very creative suggestion, but I think when you work it through the whole perek and a half, it's very compelling. And it starts the conversation between Eli and Chana. Eli says to Chana, I think you're drunk. Ostensibly because he doesn't hear her prayer. So he doesn't know what's really in her heart. And she says to him something which is really quite remarkable. And she says, amongst all the various things, she says, Al titenet amatcha lifnei bat blial. Pasuk Tzayin.
Al titen et amatcha lifnei bat
blial.
Which means what?
I don't know, do not give your maidservant before, translating it literally.
Do not give your maidservant before Bat Blial, the daughter of worthlessness. Which we understood to mean it's an idiom, an idiomatic expression. Titen lifnei would essentially get translated correctly as, do not mistake me as, right? Now, the truth is, this phrase would make a lot more sense if one word was changed.
Lifnei?
Right.
What throws us off is the word lifnei. Lifnei means before, something before something else. So, al titen et amatcha, how should it have been written?
Just get rid of lifnei.
No.
You need to replace it with something.
Or
something. Al titen et amatcha ki bat blial. If it said al titen et amatcha ki bat blial, then we would understand it means do not mistake me for a bat blial. That's not who I am. I'm really bitter. I'm really a person who has a tefillah to his request, and that's what I'm doing. And certainly, I think that's on one level what she means.
I know where you're going with this.
Right? That's what she means. However, the phrase bat blial is also a remarkable phrase, because that's not an accident. That's a very pointed phrase. It's a pointed phrase that's used.
And I'm trying to think where it was referenced before.
Right. This phrase bat blial is really a remarkable phrase.
You're not
going to
win the
Tanakh, you know? Anybody know? In this story, this phrase, Bat Blial, is a phrase laden and loaded with meaning. Heavy, heavy duty meaning. It's not an accident that she calls herself a Bat Blial.
Calling herself a Bat Blial.
Oh.
That's the issue. I don't think she's calling herself a Bat Blial, or I don't think she's accusing Eli of considering her a Bat Blial. I think she is speaking in code, speaking in euphemisms. Not an uncommon phenomenon, by the way, in Chumash. When you're talking to somebody of great stature, and you want to hit them between the eyes, you do so with kavod. Right? For example, and there's some really remarkable examples. When Moshe stood before Paro, and he wanted to say to Paro after Makat Choshech, right before Makat Becharot, that I prepared a set of pages for him with these psukim. He wants to say to Paro just before Makat Becharot that after Makat Becharot, you and your servants are going to come begging me. You're going to come. Like the song says, Paro in pajamas in the middle of the night. You're going to come begging me to leave Mitzrayim. Right? So what does it say? The Pasuk says, not v'yaradata elai, but the Pasuk says, v'yardu kol avadecha. All your servants are going to come running to me. So look at the source. Look at source number three. This is Rashi. V'yardu kol avadecha, when Moshe says to Paro, your servants are going to come calling me in the middle of the night. And in the end, it was Paro who came calling him in the middle of the night. Chalak kavod l'malchut. Moshe was given kavod to Paro. Shirei basof yordu Paro ba'atzmo. In the end, it was Paro himself who came down. Belial in the middle of the night. Vayomer kumutzu mitochami. But for lo amar lo Moshe mitchila v'yiradata elai v'yishtachaveta li. Moshe didn't want to say to him, you're going to come bow down to me. You're going to come to me. You're going to bow down to me. You're going to beg me to leave. It's not covered up. So here we're talking to Paro Melech Mitzrayim, and Moshe is speaking to him with covered. Deference. Covered. Why? Because he's still Paro Melech Mitzrayim. You got to leave, but you're still talking to Paro. Not only...
He's still trying to persuade him.
Whatever, at that point there's no persuasion left. He's talking about the gzeira of Makat Bacharot. But the phrase, v'yiradata elai, or v'yaduka lavadecha, is a function of covered. There's a few places where you have this, and some places Rashi even goes to the astounding suggestion to imply that the text was actually altered. Or at least intended to be written one way and ended up being written another. It depends on how you define a concept which Rashi refers to as tikkun sofer. For example, when Avraham stood in conversation with God about Sodom, so after the conversation was over, Pasuk says, "V'Avraham otenu omed lifnei Hashem." Right. After the whole conversation, the whole dialogue about saving stone, or actually before that whole dialogue, when after Hashem had come to Abraham in the tent, Hashem had come to him to visit him because he was sick, and now he's sending the malachim off to destroy stone, and he begins a conversation with Abraham about the destruction of stone and the negotiations about the 50 tzaddikim. So it says, "V'Avraham adenu omed lifnei Hashem." Avraham was still standing before God when God said to him, "I'm going to destroy Sodom because some Sodom and Gomorrah's the cry is great." So Rashi says, "It's backwards." Avraham wasn't standing before God. God was standing before Avraham. Who came to whom? God came to Avraham. "V'alalo alach la'amod lefanav," says Rashi. Hashem came to him, not the other way around. God said to him that Sodom v'Amora was a great cry. The pasuk should have said that God was still there. He hadn't left yet. Rashi seems to imply that Chazal reversed it. That the pasuk was written one way and Chazal turned it around. So it's a whole debate amongst the scholars whether Rashi means that the rabbis actually tampered with the text of the Torah, or does it mean that that's how it was intended to be written and it just, in order to reflect the kavod of the moment, it was written in reverse. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he talks about, in Bamidbar, it's actually this parasha, Parashat Balazcha, when he is... When there's a gzeira against the people for the terrible magefa, and Moshe says, "Al erebe ra'ati," I don't want to see my destruction, my evil. And Rashi immediately points out that the pasuk should have said, "Al erebe ra'atam." It's their destruction, it's their evil that Moshe didn't want to see. Ela shekina katuv. It's the Torah used a euphemism. There are certain moments that what you want to say is so offensive, is so intense, is so directed that you can't say it. So you reverse it. You reverse the pronoun. You talk about something else. So Moshe says, "Al erebe ra'ati," I don't want to see my evil, when he really means their evil. Moshe says to Paro, "Your servants will come to me," rather than meaning what he really intended, which is, "You will come to me." Avraham stands before God instead of God stands before Avraham. It's all a function of playing with the pronouns in order to avoid the discomfort of what you really intended to say. what Hannah really intended to say was not
Al titenet amatcha lifnei bat bliya. She really intended to say was Al titenet amatcha lifnei bnei bliya.
We don't have any bat bliyas in the story. But we do have bnei bliyal. Correct. We do have two bnei bliyal. Bnei bliyal are the two sons of Eli.
So she couldn't say it so directly because
it's male.
To say to Eli, your sons, the bnei bliyal? So there's a euphemism being employed. But in her mind, the subject of her focus here are the only two other people in the story who are referred to as Bliya'al. And that's Bnei Eli. If you take a look at Perek Bet, let's go back to the story.
But who figured this out?
So this is, again, this is not on the Mefarshim. This is a suggestion that I heard from Rav Meidan, and I think that it opens up a whole new approach to the introductory, to Chana, to her role, to the issues, to the Mikdash. We're going to see it's the beginning of an enormous iceberg, but it really unlocks a very big mystery.
I thought you were going to go somewhere with the plishtim that she was talking about. Family.
She's going to talk about the plishtim too. We're going to get to the plishtim too. We're going to get it all.
This woman had a lot to say.
Right. We're going to get to the plishtim too. We are absolutely going to get to the plishtim. That's exactly right. And all the subtext is in her tefillah.
You get a whole sense of what's going on.
That's right. You're getting pieces of the story in different parts of the story.
So is she considered a Nevi'ah?
She is considered one of the seven Nevi'ot, and part of the reason they point to for her Nevu'ah is this tefillah of Perek Bet. Again, if you look at it narrowly as Chana and Penina, and she's talking about Chana's children and Penina's funerals, to look at that as Nevu'ah is very complicated. Whereas if you see it in a much broader canvas, then it'll explain many issues, including Shmuel, including his mission, including his mandate, and the whole story will open up. But we have to start from this expression, Bnei Bliyal. Remember, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that when the story opens in Perek Aleph, and we're told of Elkanah's regular pilgrimages to the Mishkan, mm-hmm. Right, Pasuk? This person used to go up, this Elkanah and his family would go up to the Mishkan every year. To go and bring sacrifices in Shiloh. There were the two sons of Eli. In other words, from the very outset, we are told that the background, the setting to this story is the presence of Hophni and Pinchas in the Mikdash. In fact, that was the Malbim that I showed you. That the Malbim says the reason why that's mentioned here, even though Hophni and Pinchas are not the subject of the story till Perek Bet, is because we need to understand why nobody else is coming to the Mishkan. Why it's so neglected. When you're dealing with a Mishkan run by Hophni and Pinchas, you understand why it's so neglected. Flip to Perek Bet. And again, unfortunately, it's written... For us, it's not written as a kind of logical story. It's written as Perek Aleph is one aspect of the story, Chana and Penina and her children. Perek Bet is a different aspect of the story, namely Hophni and Pinchas. We are going to have to bring the two themes together. Pasuk Gid Aleph, Perek Bet Pasuk Gid Aleph, Ve'elech Elkanah Ramata El Beito, Ve'anah, referring to Shmuel, Haya Mesheretet Hashem Et Pnei Eli HaKohen. Elkanah goes home, leaves Shmuel there in the Mikdash to serve, to be raised by Eli. So image one on the one hand is Shmuel. In contrast to Shmuel, I have Eli's own two sons. Uvne Eli, Bnei Bliyal. There it is. There it is. Black and white. The description of Bnei Eli are Bnei Bliyal. So when Chana says, Al titenet hamatcha lifnei bat Bliyal, it's not such a stretch to suggest that what she really means is Al titenet hamatcha lifnei bnei bliyal. Now, why her reference to Chana and to Chofi and Pinchas would have any relevance or bearing on the conversation with Eli, we will come back to. But let's first finish the story of Eli.
I mean, that would be a good reason not to leave your kid there.
That would be a good reason not to leave your kid there, right? Not to be influenced by Chofi and Pinchas, correct? I agree. But she didn't think that way. Not only are they Bnei Belial, Lo yadu et Hashem. So if you want to understand what Bnei Belial means, like many psukim in Tanakh, they're written in couplets, in parallel, to be Bnei Belial means Lo yadu et Hashem. So what does Lo yadu et Hashem mean? What does it mean not to know God? Lo yadu et Hashem.
Don't
follow in his ways. Yeah. Follow in his ways. What do you mean? They didn't keep Shabbos. They didn't keep kosher. What does that mean?
They didn't believe.
They didn't believe. They were serving as kohanim in the mikdash, non-believers.
They weren't sincere.
They weren't sincere.
They didn't act properly.
So I'll share you a secret. There are certain phrases in Tanakh that are very, very pointed, very specific, and they're counterintuitive. Ladat et Hashem in Tanakh, or Yirat Elokim in Tanakh, which is a similar phrase you have in Bereishis, has a very, very specific connotation. For example, and I gave you three examples, so you can see it in Sifrei Nevuah, sources 4, 5, and 6. Just pulled various examples out of Tanakh. Yirmiyahu Perichapet, he happens to be talking about Yirmiyahu's description of the king. Hatimloch, Giatamit Chareb, Erez Avicha, you are going to be a king, you're going to compete with the great tower of cedar, the cedar that was your father. Your father, Halo Achal V'Shata V'Asa Mishpat U'Tztaka Az Tovlo, right, your father ate and drank, and he did Mishpat, he did justice, he did righteousness, it was good for him, he had a good time, he had a good reign. Dan Din Ani V'Evyon, judged the judgment of the poor and the destitute, az tov, that is good, halohi hadat oti ne'um Hashem. That's what it means to know God. What does it mean to know God?
To judge righteously.
To judge righteously, to do mishpat, to do tzedek, to dan aniv evyon, to judge the poor and the destitute, that, halohi hadat oti, that's what it means to know God. Look at source 5. Similarly, Yirmiyahu Perek Tet. Ki im bezot yitalel amitalel, haskel viyado oti, have knowledge, know me, ki ani Hashem oseh chesed u'mishpat u'tztaka ba'aretz. To know God means to emulate God, means to follow God. And every time we talk about following or emulating God, we talk about emulating the midah of tzedek, mishpat, chesed, compassion, rachamim, mahu rachum, mafatar rachum. Pasuk we say every single day when we put on our tefillin. Hosea, Verastich li li'olam, Verastich li betzedek uve mishpat uve chesed uve rachamim, Verastich li be'emunah v'yadat et Hashem. So the phrase l'dat et Hashem, much like the phrase in Bereishit of Yirat Elokim, which is used, when does Abraham refer to Yirat Elokim? When he talks about the fact that in Mitzrayim they have no fear of God, they were going to kill him because of his wife. Rak en yirat elokim b'makom hazeh v'harguni al dvar ishti. There is a point in which the notion of ladat et Hashem is not a theological notion, it's a social notion. It's a notion of how you treat others. And it's counterintuitive, because we would see it as a theological concept, da'at et Hashem, belief, trust, following God's ways. In Tanakh, it's a social concept. If you are cruel to people, if you are evil to people, especially when you should know better, then you are described as being lo yadu et Hashem or b'nei Belial. So now the question becomes, what was so evil about this Chofni Pinchas? What did they do that was so terrible? And that's ultimately the question that we need to start to explore. What was their crime? If we understand their crime, we're going to work it backwards to see if and how it might have been relevant to Chana. So let's go on from here in Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Gimel.
So you're implying that the prayer had certainly something to do with the two sons.
Correct.
And perhaps something with society in general.
Well, maybe society in general. We'll see that with the plishtim. We haven't gotten to that yet, but certainly with Bnei, with Chafni Pinchas. I'm going to argue that the enemies she's referring to in the beginning of her tefillah are Chafni Pinchas, not Chana.
Right. That's what you
were alluding right. to. Yeah. Mechav Pi, I think, is a reference to Chafni Pinchas.
Which, of course, would make more sense with her harshness.
Yes.
Well, no question. And once...
That falls into place.
Then... And it doesn't work with the Medrashim, it doesn't work with the Mefarshim, but again, it certainly, I think, opens up a whole new understanding of what's going on, and it'll help us project from Chana all the way forward the whole story of Shmuel. Let's go back. Perek Bet, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Let's understand who Chafni and Pinchas are and why they are described as Bnei Bliya'al Lo Yadu At Hashem. That's quite a title. Very few people get that title, that indictment. B'nei B'liyal lo yadu et Hashem. Worthless, not God-fearing scum. That is
pretty bad.
U'mishpat ha'kohanim et ha'am. Here's what they used to do. This was their behavior pattern. Kol ish zaveach zevach. Somebody would bring a sacrifice. Uva nar hakohen kivashala basar, the nar hakohen, this young kohen lad, referring to, of course, Chafni and Pinchas, would come when the meat was cooking. V'hamazleg shlosh ha'shinayim biyado, with the fork, the three-pronged fork in his hand. So here's the image, right? You've got Chafni and Pinchas walking around the mikdash with a three-pronged fork. Big pitchfork. And they would use this pitchfork to stab the meat in the pot. Vika bakior, or badud, or bakalachat, or baparur. They would take this big pot, or this cauldron, or whatever this meat was cooking in. And they would stab the meat with their fork.
That's why we have a lot of vegetarians.
Kol asher yaleh amazleg, yikach ha-kohen bo. And the kohen would take his portion from whatever that meat, whatever that fork could stab. Boom! That's mine. Kacha ya'asu l'chol Yisrael haba'im sham b'shilo. And that's how they treated everybody who came to Shiloh.
They took everything they brought?
They took whatever they wanted out of the pot with their fork. Boom! Now, here's a problem. There's a sequence in the Mikdash. The sequence is that the korban goes first on the mizbeach. When the mizbeach is finished with the various parts that go, the chaylev and the etc., then
the kohen gets
what's left, depending on the korban. Sometimes the kohen gets what's left. Sometimes the balabait gets what's left, and the kohen gets a portion. Matnot kuna. Says the pasuk, gam beterem yaktidun et chaylev. This was before the chaylev ever got close to the mizbeach.
They took theirs first.
They got theirs first. Uva na'ar ha-kohen v'yamar le'isha zoveach t'na basar litzlot ha-kohen. Comes along the na'ar ha-kohen and says to the person bringing the sacrifice, give me meat. I want beef. Boom. Fork. V'lo yimkach mimcha basar mevushal ki imcha. I'm not waiting for it to be cooked. I want it raw. Yeah. You know the last person who said that was?
Esav.
Right, Esav, when he said to Yaakov, I want that meat and I want it now. Ha'alitaini na min adom adom hazeh. Esav style. Vayomer elav ha'ish. No, the person said in response, kater yaktirut kayom ha'chelev. Wait a second, the chelev has to go to the mizbeach first. My dear Chafni Pinchas, a little patience. V'kach l'cha kashir taveh nefshecha. After that you can have to your heart's desire. Which, by the way, is a very interesting phrase, because Taven Afshecha is the phrase the Torah uses for non-sacrificial meat. Zevachta kasher Taven Afshecha. And here it's being used to describe sacrificial meat, which is really ironic. However, the Kohanim, Chafni Pinchas, they weren't buying it. Va'amarlo ki atatiten. No, I want it
now.
Ha'aliteni na. Now. Give it to me raw. Ve'imlo. Lakachti b'chozka. I'm going to take it by force. Don't start up with the man with the pitchfork. I've got my... We're going to talk about Eli, too. We're going to talk about Eli.
They don't say their names, either. Yeah. They don't specifically
they don't deserve it. B'nai Belial. They don't deserve their names. But we're going to talk about why Eli, and what he does know, and he doesn't know, and his role. We're going to get to all of this.
I mean, this is the beginning of the end, no?
This is the end of Shiloh, right? Yeah. This is Eli's, yeah. Shmuel's first nevuah is the destruction, is the fall of Shiloh. V'atehi chatat ha'narim gdola me'od et tnei Hashem. The sin of these Na'arim was great before God. They caused the mincha, the offering of God, to become despised.
Wow.
That's
pretty... In contrast to Chofni and Pinchas, with this paragraph started with Shmuel Misharetet Hashem, and it ends with Shmuel Misharetet Hashem. Here is Shmuel, young Shmuel, serving God, wearing an ephod, wearing a me'il, whom his mother made for him every year when his mother would come visit him. And his mother had more children. The contrast between Chofni and Pinchas and Shmuel permeates every part of this paragraph. This is really horrific. This picture, this image of Chofni and Pinchas walking around the temple courtyard with a pitchfork, stabbing meat into every cauldron. I want it now. I want
raw.
It raw. Esav style. All right. Now comes the most remarkable part of the story of Chofni and Pinchas. Pasuk Chaf Bet. Ve'eli, Ruthie, here's the answer to your question. Ve'eli zaken mo'od. Eli's an old man. V'shama et kol asher yasun b'nai l'chol Yisrael. He heard what all that his sons had done to B'nai Yisrael. V'et asher yishkevun et hanashim hatzovot petach o'al mo'ed. And how they would come and... I'm going to translate it literally, even though it's a very harsh pasuk, and Chazal were very offended by anybody who translated it literally. But literally it translates as how they would sleep with the women who gathered at the entrance of the Ohel Moed. So we have gone from a pitchfork
to rape.
Right?
Yeah.
To violating the women as they gathered at the entrance of the Ohel Moed, which is a really an intolerable accusation.
Yeah.
Wow. Not finished. Because Chazal were very, very articulate about the fact that that clearly was not what's going on.
It was just an expression.
And now we're going to get to just an expression, right? Another one of these expressions. If she's implying the euphemism in one direction, the Navi was implying the euphemism in the other direction. Vayomer lahem. So now Eli heard all this, so he can't not say anything, right? You have to say it. So he says, he responds. Vayomer lahem. Lama ta'asun kadvarim ha'elem. My dear Chofni and Pinchas. Why are you doing these things? I'm hearing terrible things about you. Why are you doing these terrible things? Albanai, no, my children. These rumors that I hear about you, they're not good. Ma'avirim am Hashem, transgressing the people, the nation of God. Understand this, my dear friends. Im yechta ish le'ish ufilelo Elohim. If a man sins against another man, so he always has the option of praying to God. Ve'im la'Hashem yechta'ish. But if you sin against God, mi'it palelo, who are you going to pray to? You understand his critique? He says, you know, if you had sinned against man, it's a big deal. You always pray to God. But yeah, you're violating the korbanot. You're sinning against God. That's a terrible thing, because then you have nobody left to pray to. V'lo yishmu l'kol avihem. They would not listen to God, to their father. Ki chafet Hashem l'amita. And we'll talk about what that phrase means. God desired to ultimately punish them for what they had done. V'ana Shmuel olech v'gadel v'tov gam im Hashem v'gam im anashim. In contrast, Shmuel, good with man, good with God. Shmuel is the ultimate anti-Chofni and Pinchas.
He seems like a total orphan, you know. Ellie's out of it. These two are running around. And he's by himself.
Well, we're going to talk about Shmuel. We need to spend we need to focus on Chafni Pinchas first, then we'll come back to Shmuel. But you are correct. Now,
there's no mention of any mothers.
We don't know where if she's still alive. Eli's a very old man. He's in his 90s. We don't know anything about the mother.
Mrs. Ailey.
Now, comes along Chazal in the Gemara in Shabbos. The Gemara in Shabbos is source number 7. No, we're not going to do this. We are not going to have time. So here's where we are going to leave this. We are going to stop here. And we have much to cover. We have to figure out what the real sin of Chafni Pinchas was, how this issue, the dynamic of the relationship between the descriptions of the two different sins, because the description of the sins appears twice. Once with regards to the pitchfork, and once with regards to the women. And the emphasis seems to be that the greater offense is on the pitchfork. And yet, I mean, that's remarkable. So we need to figure that out. Once we understand Chafni Pinchas is the chait, then we've got to go back to Chana and figure out how any of this, if at all, relates to Chana, and ultimately then back to her tefillah.
Well, how does she know about Chafni Pinchas?
That is what we're going to find out. So now the question is,